As you think about your entrepreneurial journey, are you thinking about geography as well as economics? Making a physical journey to a new place on the globe where you can make a business impact? Paul Tenney did, and his journey is fascinating.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute, applying the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free tools, resources, key takeaways, and actionable insights from each episode, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. At Economics for Entrepreneurs, we prize the metaphor of the entrepreneurial journey, the idea that entrepreneurship is a process with preparation and first steps and ongoing progress, that there's learning and adjustment along the way, that you meet great people and encounter interesting experiences, and that you grow personally and individually while you're on the trip. A journey is a story. Steve Denning, who's been a guest on Economics for Entrepreneurs, wrote a book called The Leader's Guide to Storytelling, in which he asserts that storytelling is the best form of strategy. It describes a destination and how to get there, and it can unite a group or a team in a shared mission and a collaborative enterprise. Our overarching story at Economics for Entrepreneurs is the journey to an entrepreneurial society, one in which innovation and entrepreneurship represent the integral life-sustaining activity in our organizations and our firms and our economy, the most normal, ongoing, everyday activity, a lifestyle and a life decision for everyone. The great individual stories are those of innovative entrepreneurs who put their own stamp on the journey, make unique choices, take unique paths, and make unique contributions in facilitating unique value for their customers. Our aim is to keep telling these stories to serve as both examples and inspiration. Our guest today, Paul Tenney, resides in Singapore, which is itself a great story of a small nation that has prospered by encouraging its entrepreneurs. Paul chose an industry that he identified as generally high in potential growth and in generating new customer needs to be met. And then he chose a geography where he found a particularly high potential opportunity in that industry. Sometimes it's that industry-geography combination that can deliver a different type of opportunity. Let's listen to Paul's journey story. Hi, Paul. Welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Hey, Hunter. Great to be here.
Well, good. Well, thank you very much for being our guest. We love entrepreneurial stories, journey stories that illustrate the possibilities of entrepreneurial imagination and the seizing of opportunities and deploying one's individual human capital in unique ways to serve others in the market and feeling good about doing it. I think the fancy term for that is self-actualization, but feeling good will do. So your journey is a great example, and we're going to use it today to motivate listeners who might be thinking of making their own journey right now.
All right, that sounds great.
So I'm going to start at Stanford University because I saw that you have a degree in philosophy, computer science, and economics, which that's an odd combination. I mean, odd in the sense of unusual combination. Did you assemble that yourself, or did Stanford assemble it for you?
Well, the reality there is that it's not true. My degree is in philosophy. I think what you're seeing is a bit of a LinkedIn artifact. I wanted to at least communicate that I had done some other things. I took an Econ 1 class from the famous John Taylor.
Oh yeah, the Taylor rule.
And that was about it for economics. But started studying Austrian economics on my own. So I sort of wanted to put a nod in there to that, but not necessarily scream out on LinkedIn that I was some kind of Austrian economist or something.
Well, tell us about that though. How did you learn Austrian economics? How did you come across it, and why did you take it up, and why was that important for you?
Yeah, so let's see. I guess my grandfather on my father's side was involved with the Mises Institute from a fairly early stage. So He was based in San Francisco Bay Area and had started attending some of the Mises events out there in the 90s. My father eventually got into it, and during my Stanford days, I picked it up myself as well, and we all did a trip out to the Mises Institute in early 2002 while I was still at Stanford, I think. And so that's how I got into that. Came from the family side of things. Certainly not through anything that was happening at Stanford.
Well, great. So you did, though, in an innovative sense, combine philosophy, computer science, and economics. Have you found that that's been a useful combination for you?
Yeah, it has. And I think, you know, most people think philosophy and sort of wonder what you're going to do with that. I suppose that's probably how you end up in email marketing.
Naturally.
But, you know, if effectively it's all a matter of logic and being able to hold, you know, large volumes of unstructured information in your head, which translates very nicely to digital marketing and to especially database marketing, which is sort of in my lifelong career here.
Well, let's find out about that. But I'm going to keep going chronologically, if you don't mind, because we're tracing a journey here. So if your LinkedIn is right, you went into the business world at Charles Schwab in client services. Was that a kind of personal choice to go into client services because it would lead you to something else, or was it opportunistic? Tell us about the beginning of your journey there.
Well, so the timing was interesting. I graduated in 2002, which was just after the dot-com bust had kicked in. So, you know, I have an older brother who is 2 years ahead of me. So he graduated 2000 from Stanford. You know, when I first arrived, everybody at Stanford thought they were going to walk off campus and be millionaires overnight working in the vaccine. By the time I got out of there, it was a bust, and it was a hard bust. So there was, you know, not much happening in the tech scene, and there was it was hard just for anybody to find jobs in those days. So I actually I signed up with a temp agency, and they gave me a job at Charles Schwab, and that was my first sort of entree into the business world. So like many things in life, it was a pure accident.
Charles Schwab today is kind of on the cutting edge of applying technology to servicing consumers in the consumer service business. They were early to the robo-advisor and online trading and that kind of thing. Were they like that back then when you joined them in 2002?
They were trying. It was an interesting business. I mean, you know, let's see, I guess at the time too, you had what was it, like Sarbanes-Oxley coming in and stuff like that. So there was, you know, a lot of compliance requirements, but there was also just a huge need for technology applications. So I remember they had a large scale project underway that I was peripherally involved with. But it was so incredibly slow to get anything done. I sort of decided in those days to stay away from the financial services sector from a technology standpoint. But it was clear that the interest and the desire was there. So, you know, whatever, almost 20 years later, maybe they finished a few of those projects.
And then following your chronology, you made a move into Hotwire, which I presume was a hot startup at that point in time, a high-flying internet innovator. Is that right? And why did you decide to go there?
Yeah, so actually, the chronology is a bit funky there, but I actually first went to Yesmail, which was my entree into the email marketing world, which I spent a little bit over a year there. So I should probably come back to that piece. That was, you know, in those days, I was living in San Francisco and commuting down to San Carlos, sort of the valley, not really the valley. But the woman who had hired me initially had made a move to Hotwire and recruited me to come there. It was a job up in the city. And I thought, hey, that sounds a lot better than driving down to San Carlos from the city every day, get on a BART train and go down to work. So I made that move. I don't know if I want to jump into that now or go reverse chronological, but there's an interesting story to it.
Well, tell us a story. That's what we're listening for.
Well, so let's see. I guess I had been doing something prior to that, and I guess we can come back to that in a moment, which I quite enjoyed, and I sort of made a career move without really weighing in all the consequences of it. I was still a fairly young guy at the time, but I got to Hotwire, and I just absolutely did not enjoy the working environment there. The company was quite cool and a very well run and very efficient company, but the culture was lacking in a number of ways that I didn't find myself enjoying. So I spent about 4.5 months there and actually got fired from the job. So that was my first and only time I got fired. So I think it was shortly after that that I realized I don't think I'm cut out to go work for somebody else, and eventually I'm going to need to start my own business. So I was about 26 at the time, 25, 26 at the time. But so that was sort of the impetus to say, I better think about a different long-term plan. So that was sort of the origin of it, but I knew it was going to be a long plan to get where I wanted to go.
Well, just drill down for us a little bit, Paul, into that feeling, because it's an interesting process and transition for aspiring entrepreneurs. You said you decided, I'm probably not cut out to work for someone else. What then happens in your assessment to go through that long-term plan of how do I get to being self-employed or an entrepreneur or a startup CEO? Can you tell us a little bit about the thinking process there?
Yeah, I suppose I did. There was one correct part of my thinking and one incorrect part of my thinking at that point. But the first part, the correct part, was I was going to need skills and experience and business know-how and that sort of thing. So, one of the what ended up happening is that I went back to my previous job at Yesmail, which was a very good opportunity to pick up a lot of different kinds of business skills. I practically had an executive role at sort of the tender age of 26, and so that was the right part about it, was just go start learning all the skills that you need, build a track record, all of that kind of thing. The part that I probably made a mistake on was thinking that the other ingredient I would need is to build up capital. So I was attempting to go through a savings route to build enough capital to start a business, which I've since learned is a terrible way to go about building a business.
We're traveling with Paul Tenney on his entrepreneurial journey, and it's pretty exciting. Wherever you are on your journey, or if you're contemplating starting one, we have tools, methods, and processes for every step. You can access them at e4epod.com/journey to purchase our Austrian Entrepreneur's Journey online course. That's e4epod.com/journey. We hope you'll try it. And now back to our conversation. Well, let's come back to that. That's an important piece of information, but maybe we'll get to it later when you've launched your business. So I want to cover a couple of things. One was the field that you talked about was database marketing. And was that in its infancy back then, and did you sense that it was going to be something that would grow? Tell us about database marketing when you first got into it.
Yes, it was. I would say it was still fairly early stage. I think that by the time I was there, the market was less than 10 years old. So it's on the scale of things, still pretty new. Most of the businesses had all most of the people who were sort of the bigger companies in the space had all started in the late 90s during the .com days. So there's sort of an interesting, sort of post-.com bubble, how do I put it? Things became old school very fast in a way. Some of the technology had lagged behind, but the concepts were very interesting. There was a lot to be figured out and a lot of problems to go solve. And a lot of opportunity to go solve them. At the time, when I say database marketing, pretty much the primary and only marketing channel that was in use was email marketing. Today, there's lots and lots and lots of different ways people do that. I suppose in the older, you know, sense of things, database marketing would go back to, you know, catalogs and direct mail and all of that kind of thing as well. That obviously had largely died out. So from a digital perspective, it was email marketing. The interesting thing there is, if you recall back to those days, this was 2004 when I started in that space. Email marketing was a highly stigmatized line of business. So everybody had problems with spam in their inbox, and you know, that was sort of the bane of email those days, was you know, getting illicit spam emails in your inbox all the time. So it wasn't much fun at a, you know, at a cocktail party to explain to somebody that I did email marketing. It meant everybody thinks you're a spammer. Of course, it's a perfectly legitimate, you know, business where you're, you know, I was working with companies like Hewlett Packard and Macy's and Coca-Cola and, you know, large global brands like that. But what it sort of signaled to me was it's going to be a very interesting opportunity, because most people are not going to go into that line of business, even though there's a great business to be had there.
So you had developed this this positive view of the potential of that business. And then there's this geographic leap in your story to Singapore, which is where you are now while I'm talking to you. So can you tell us about the geographical leap?
Yeah, sure. So I suppose fairly early on, as I started thinking about building and growing my own business, let's see, I guess I'd always had a bit of an eye towards Asia, though I had never been and didn't really have any experience in it. I grew up in Seattle with a lot of Japanese culture, took a little bit of Japanese language when I was young. I always sort of figured I would wind up over in Japan at some point or something like that. But I knew that there was business opportunities there. We were doing some work for some of the global customers that I had from San Francisco into the Asia market. So I was already working with customers in Australia and in Japan and a few other markets. So I knew that there was opportunity available there, and started thinking about it from a planning perspective. And then as I was sort of getting serious about thinking about that, the company I was working for also was thinking about opening up an office over in Asia and offered me to go to Singapore to set up an office for them there.
And you told me that was a scary but just do it moment. Tell us about how you were feeling about that.
Well, I think I was, I was ready for something new and ready for a change. And you know, the years I spent in San Francisco, you know, after university days, 2003 to 2009, at that point when I made the decision, it was pretty slow in the tech scene in those days in San Francisco. And I thought there's got to be a new adventure out there. So I was pretty ready to go do something new. One thing though was they said, here, you're going to go to Singapore. And, you know, like most Americans, I think, you know, about all I knew about Singapore was that you couldn't chew gum and some guy had gotten caned there one time. So that was a bit the scary side of it. But I think, you know, once I made the move and the jump, I think I, about 24 hours after I hit the ground, had a brief moment of, what the hell am I doing here? But then that passed and I moved on pretty quickly.
So you were running a big piece of geography for your employer back there. So you've now got this formula of, I've got the industry that I think has potential, email marketing. I've got geography where there's huge potential. What did you have that was kind of unique, was a competitive advantage for your corporation or for your email methodology, where you're starting to find out where there were opportunities for uniqueness there?
Yeah, and let's see, I was at the time running the Singapore and Asia business. I was also running the London and European business from Singapore. So I was also traveling to Europe regularly at that point as well. So I'd sort of been around the world and seen how things worked, you know, at least in three major continents. My background and what I was doing for this company was in client services, or what we're now calling customer success. So I was never a sales guy nor an engineer as such. But I think what I learned along the way was, you could do whatever needed to be done by providing proper service to the customers and service to the clients, that solving problems and getting what they needed done was probably more important than even what the technology was capable of doing or did do or that sort of thing. So that was sort of my background, was more in going and figuring out what the problems are and solving them.
With a customer service orientation, right? The solving the customer's needs.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I think it kind of started, it's funny to even explain this to younger people now, but 15 years ago, technology broke a lot of the time. So we sort of expect things to work these days. But a lot of times it was just a matter of, you know, things that were supposed to be working weren't working. And how do you figure out a workaround to, you know, say you're trying to send a blast email out the door to 10 million people and the mail's not going out. What do you do? So a lot of times it was just sort of figuring out the very practical problems that customers had, more so than even, you know, the pie in the sky kinds of stuff that you can do with digital marketing.
And holding their hand while you get them through the problem. I think I find that a big part of customer service as well.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, a matter of communication and making sure that the person knows that something's being worked on and that there's some initiative underway to get their problem resolved, and just making sure that they're well taken care of is, you know, probably the most important part about any sort of, and I was going to say broad business, but at least in the digital marketing space, I think that's pretty critical.
So now you've got an industry that you focused on. You've got geography that you can select from in terms of high potential. You've got the business skill of customer service, and you know there's a need for that. And then you become CEO and founder of your own company. Tell us about that decision, Paul. How did you finally take that?
Yeah, so I actually did it was sort of an interesting multi-step hop that I took. I always had an intention of going and setting up my own business, but I did want to spend at least a few years in the market working with the company that sent me out to help build their business first, give myself a chance to sort of learn the market, get the experience, that sort of thing. What happened along the way was just after I arrived in Singapore, the company that I was working for at the time was a NASDAQ listed company, and it got bought over and taken back private by a private equity firm just after I arrived in Singapore. So they basically said, I said, well, what would you guys like me to do here? And they said, pretty much just keep a chair warm for a while there. So what happened was I actually approached them and said, hey, you know what? There's a market here. I can go run this. But if you guys aren't ready to invest in it or manage it, why don't I just set up a reseller agreement with you guys, and I'll take care of your customers as an employee, but I'll also run a reseller business, and I'll go out and start driving new customers myself.
And they agreed to that?
They did, and the folks who were the management team at the time were obviously supporters of mine to have sent me out to Singapore in the first place, but they were a great group of people, and they said, that sounds great. And everybody was happy with the arrangement. And so I actually started and was running the company while still an employee of the company. So I was doing both client services on one side and sales and new customers and business expansion on the other.
So could we call that partnering? I mean, that's one of the buzzwords in how to build a capacity for your company. You can partner for it. Is that the right way to look at that?
It is. And that's exactly what today sort of the core of our one part of our business. We've got a technology business, so we also build and run our own technology too. But the original piece of the business was primarily built around a partnership model. Where I saw a business opportunity there was, you know, basically in digital marketing, the pricing models work such that if you've got higher volume, your unit economic your unit cost goes down, so you've got economies of scale. And you know, one of the propositions I had, which originally started the business, was, you know, because I can manage and run a program by myself, I can have a collection of customers, but to you, the company who's my partner, I can just be one single customer. So I cut down your service costs and your engineering costs and your support costs significantly, but I get better unit economics on it. So it's effectively a resale business where you're buying buying cheap and selling it at the list price.
But then your individual customers, the Paul Tenney customers, get the benefits of that scale, which they wouldn't otherwise get from a smaller company, right?
That's right. And also then the big key to me, and especially when you deal with a geographical challenge like the Pacific Ocean being between you and the technology provider, is localizing the support. So, you know, and that was something I even learned back in the US. I was in San Francisco, but found that in order to do the business well, we went and opened up an office in Los Angeles because our customers down there needed to see people face to face more often than I could be on a plane to get down there and see them. And when you get into the market in Asia, you know, there's a lot of people in Asia, but especially in Southeast Asia, you know, the size of the countries aren't so big. So, you know, you might have, if I'm working with a big company in the US, they might have a nationwide marketing program for the US that's got 10 million people in their database. But you have in Asia, you have 200,000 in Singapore and 500,000 in Thailand and 800,000 in Indonesia. It's very fragmented. So the approach we came up with was, let's provide localized service. And what that enabled us to do is bring technology to the market that people really weren't able to use by just buying it off the shelf or buying it from a company that didn't have the localized support. A lot of these countries, English is not the primary language, so we needed to have local language support. And we found it was much easier to localize with people than it was to localize with technology, which is a bit of a strange concept to most people, but I can prove it.
No, so you, if I were to sum up your value proposition, it's a big company, big scale technology with localized service and support, including things like language customization, that kind of thing. Is that right? Is that your value proposition?
Yeah, completely. From a partnership perspective, and that's how we originally drew up the business was primarily we would make money by reselling products, sometimes selling a service component too. Although I am a believer that you should sell as little service as possible and include as much for free as you can. But that was sort of the phase one of the business was just getting that propped up and getting the localized delivery arms available. And then we started to go into building some of our own technology from there.
Well, just 1 second before you get there, how did you go out and recruit customers for that business model?
Okay. Let's see, I guess, initially, when I launched the business in full and made the move into Ematic Solutions from Yasmail, I recruited first a couple of my former colleagues from the U.S. to come out and join me. So, the first thing we had done was I did a small fundraising from what you would call friends and family, and it was truly friends and family and colleagues of mine from the U.S. The other interesting story there was I got married in 2013 just before we launched Ematic Solutions, and you know, getting people to come from the U.S. out to Singapore for a wedding was tricky. The pretty much the only people who came were the friends and family who invested in the business, and a couple of the guys who came out, I just said, why don't you guys just stay out here and we'll get this thing launched, and
yeah,
two of them did.
That's great.
So yeah. Then I had never really done sales before, so I just had been doing a ton of networking to get out and start talking to people initially. So, you know, I went and met everybody I could and got them to give me further introductions. And when we started going to market in earnest, it was a lot of just sort of more conversational, figuring out who had some needs and challenges and where we could get in and operate. And we had a lot of friendly people who let us come in and start experimenting with their businesses. So
tell us about that. Tell us about the growth curves. You find some customers, they invite you in. You've hinted that you started adding some of your own services to the reseller services. Tell us a little bit about the growth curve, how it progressed.
Yeah, so let's see. I guess we were effectively initially sort of doing consulting. And the idea was to go kind of figure out from our customers what sort of challenges and needs they had that we thought could be addressed at scale. So not on a one-by-one basis, but where's there opportunities to build technology that's sort of missing in the space that we could go deliver to the market. So what we did was we ran lots and lots of experiments. So we went and started working with companies and we said, hey, why don't you try this technology X or this technology Y? Sometimes it worked well, sometimes it didn't work well. Sometimes we found that, you know, it was a great product, but it was too intensive to go through the setup process or too much work to manage or too much cost or these kinds of things. And basically the idea was we'd sort of profitably experiment until we found some things that looked interesting. So we eventually said, all right, we've got a couple of pretty interesting technology ideas, and we started building and developing that and then trying those out with our customers to make sure that they worked and that sort of thing. Once we had sort of proven that use case out, then we went out to the VC market out here and started doing our first fundraising.
So a couple of questions there before we get to capital. You're talking about experiments in email marketing. Just help us out here. Is that purely the technology of distributing the emails by technical means, or does it include the creative?
That's a fantastic question. One thing is I've become somewhat famous for like absolutely positively not caring about content or creative when it comes to email marketing. But the real sort of challenge and issue there is you're limited in your experimentation framework by the amount of content that can be generated and approved. So, you know, I could come up with programmatic content that would, go scour Google and Facebook and come up with interesting images. But if I, send a message out for Coca-Cola that's got, I don't know, something off-brand in it, they're not going to be happy with that, even if the content performs well. So what we started looking at was what sort of levers do we have to pull with data that can be accessed programmatically and with experiments that can be run without having to stop a marketer from whatever it is that they're doing. So the basic concept there is, the companies that we work with, a marketing team has enough challenges just sort of getting tomorrow's campaign together and getting the content ready and, getting all the approvals done and sending out the messages. What we started looking at was where can we do some experiments to improve what happens once they press the send button, basically. Mm-hmm. So the phenomena that I'd identified back by like 2005, 2006 are kind of most interesting technology today is it's pretty obvious in a certain sense, but if I send you marketing content, you might be interested today, but tomorrow you'll be less interested. 5 years from now, you'll be completely uninterested. And there's some sort of a curve there where people start to drop off after a while, regardless of what content you're sending them. It's just sort of a natural fatigue that happens as people get tired of your marketing content over time. So the kind of core algorithm that we built was basically looking at all the activity. So we can, every time we send out an email message, we know who we sent it to, how long that person's been subscribed, how many times we've sent them messages in the past. Did they open the message? Did they click the message? Did they buy anything from the message? All that information is available. And what we modeled is the fatigue curve, basically. And so what we do is we predict, maybe you've got a million people in your database that you're going to send to today. We look at it and say, hey, these 800,000 people are not going to open or click your message today. So just don't send to them.
And then can you come back to them later when their fatigue is worn off, if that's the right expression?
Yeah, and what we've modeled also is that sort of a absence makes the heart grow fonder concept is mm-hmm. if you lay off of somebody for a while, they will slightly get more inclined to engage with a marketing message in the future. So basically it models the rate of fatigue and then the rate of what we call rehabilitation. You can tell we like to go to the bars.
So you've developed original analysis, it sounds like, an original technology to address that through your algorithm. Is that accurate?
Yep, correct. And then we've built some other tools along the way that's sort of been our biggest hit so far. But the idea is I suppose from a marketing, maybe this is an interesting point for Austrian economics folks, but my belief is that whether there is such thing as intellectual property or not, in the world of digital marketing, it's absolutely irrelevant. Mm-hmm. So I've never seen in the world of digital marketing anybody successfully deploy intellectual property against somebody else and prevent them from doing almost the exact same thing. And the reason is because the you can do all kinds of different marketing in various different ways. And, you know, one methodology that somebody comes up with, there's so many possible workarounds. There's no way to stop somebody from doing effectively the same thing you are, even if you've got IP.
Right. So that's what we call keep calling flexible dynamics, right? You got to keep going faster than the other guy can copy you.
That's right. And then the other thing, and this probably sounds funny to most people, but I also just don't view marketing technology as permanent. So I think a lot of companies go mm-hmm. try to build something that, you know, is going to be the wave of the future for the next 20 years. And we just say, you know, like, let's just go build technology until it's irrelevant, right? So just go build it, run it as far as it goes. And if in a year's time, everybody else is doing it, bring out something new.
And are you building that something new in parallel, anticipating the wear out, or?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea is sort of to build, the idea is to be fairly nimble with it. What we've done is, and this kind of goes to a product development lifecycle consideration. But what I didn't like in the Silicon Valley and in the US and in more developed markets was, you know, people had to get fairly sophisticated products together before they'd ever go out and start testing it in the market. And a lot of times I found that by the time they did all the investment and did all the product development and got it out to the market, it was already not what the market needed by the time they got it there. So what we basically have taken as an approach is we've introduced a layer into a traditional sort of user experience concept. But what we do is we use our customer success team to generate the problem statements that our customers have and figure out where can we attack those problem statements with technology that can be deployed tomorrow, not in 6 months' time, not in a year's time.
So a lot of that sounds like what the software world calls agile today. And we've had a couple of discussions about that on the podcast. Do you consider yourself an agile company at Ematic Solutions?
I don't think I did until I started listening to your podcast. for anybody listening out there, I started listening to Hunter's podcast and thought, oh, this is exactly what I'm doing, but I just haven't been calling it this. So I think that would be a fairly accurate description. Now, from a technology standpoint, I actually don't like the term agile when it comes to development, because that's been used for a long time. And, you know, everybody gets into, are we doing Scrum? Are we doing, you know, Kanban, yada, yada, yada. There's lots of different stuff in the product world. And I like it less from an application of product and technology, but from a business standpoint, it makes a lot of sense. And I think that the approach is very much aligned with sort of how we've built and run the business.
Yeah, the main point for me anyway is in Agile is putting the customer very early in the production process. And it sounds like you do that. Your customer service teams go out and listen to what the customer is saying, turn that into a problem statement, and they start working on solving the problem. So they're up front in the process. That's my head-held concept of Agile.
Yeah, and I think, you know, your point around delivering value to the customer as sort of being the primary function of any business, really, it 100% starts from there. And, you know, what I saw a lot of in sort of enterprise marketing technology back in the Silicon Valley is a lot of the products are being developed by the sales teams more than anything else. So, you know, Microsoft issues an RFP for a $100 million contract. You get a bunch of people go in and bid on the contract, and basically whoever doesn't get the deal comes back and complains to their product team it's because they didn't have feature X, Y, or Z.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of figuring out, you can do anything with any set of tools when it comes to digital marketing and that sort of thing. So the real exercise is trying to figure out what the actual problems the customer has is, and not just generating another widget to keep up with the next company over.
We're learning a lot from Paul Tenney about how he designed and executed his entrepreneurial journey, which is still unfolding. Are you at the beginning of your journey or contemplating starting one? You can gain a lot from our free video, The New Logic of Entrepreneurship, explaining how entrepreneurship is open to all and the process for getting started and building the strongest possible business foundation. Get it at e4epod.com/newlogic. That's e4epod.com/newlogic. And now back to our conversation. So let's dive into value theory a little bit, Paul, since you brought it up. This is a genuine question we're debating now. So we've gone through the economics of value is embedded in the product, which kind of goes back to Adam Smith. And then you talked about being in the service business. The service economy came up with the idea of co-creation, that the provider and the customer work together to co-create the product. And now some of the thinking is drifting all the way to what they call customer dominant logic. All of the value is in the customer. You just enable them to create their own value by doing their own unique efforts with what you provide them as a service. Where do you stand on that? Are you in the co-creation camp, or are your customers creating their own value?
Excuse me. That's a pretty interesting question. One of the things I suppose one of the things that attracted me to the digital marketing space is I think the technology in digital marketing moves as fast as anything anywhere. So even compared to financial services and other things, the landscape just keeps changing and keeps evolving very quickly. One funny result of that is that I don't think most companies anywhere in the world are equipped to keep up with the pace of change of marketing technology.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, even if you've got a big team of marketers working with the latest and greatest technology, you're going to buy one particular product or solution and use that and get good with that. Meanwhile, you're not getting your hands on the other 50 options that you could have been looking at. So you're not really getting expertise in the broad scope of what's going on in the market. So the statement I'm about to make here sounds, I don't know if it's a good statement or a bad statement, but I actually wouldn't even go as far as the co-creation piece, and certainly not into the, you know, what was the last part about just the customer goes and makes their own value?
Yeah, the customer creates their own value.
Yeah, so that piece in at least the landscape I'm working in, I don't think works. How they perceive the value of the things that they're buying is in the eye of the beholder 100%. But what I've seen is that most people are not using even 5 to 10% of the capabilities of the tool sets that they're buying in the digital marketing world.
Yeah.
So what we like to do is sort of get in close enough to figure out what it is that the marketers and our customers really need. So they're co-creators in the sense that they're providing access and insights into what's needed. But we, I want to sort of obviate that from their needs and just go solve their problems. So they can go just discover that their lives are easier and that their jobs are easier tomorrow without having to really think about what's happened in between.
Are you able to help them realize more than 5% of the capability of the technology? Are you able to help them raise their own game, shall we say?
Yeah, the approach there is to use simpler technology and use it to its maximum capability. So we get to 100% by saying, like, here, don't use this thing that's too sophisticated. Use this thing that's a little bit less sophisticated, but use 100% of it. And use that until you've outgrown it demonstrably, and then pull in the next step. So there is a bit of a crawl, walk, run type of approach there, where over time, more sophistication can occur. But in general, what I would say is the stuff that we're doing today is a lot less sophisticated than it was 15 years ago. It's getting simpler as opposed to more complex.
Really?
We used to do a lot of dynamic content and personalization and things of this nature. And what we found is that the assembly process of going through and building out all the necessary logic and doing the quality assurance to make sure that, you know, you, Hunter, are getting, an advertisement for shoes and I'm getting an advertisement for shirts and that's all correct and that sort of thing, it actually takes more manpower to execute all of that than it does just to say, here, let's just send out a communication to Hunter and to Paul and say, hey, there's stuff on our website that is interesting for you.
Mm-hmm.
So personalization isn't bad when it gets onto the web and to mobile apps where you're sitting on the data. The problem is all the rest of the channels don't have all of your data there inherently, and you've got to push all your data to those other channels to make them more effective.
Well, at the general level, though, that's a huge service, isn't it? Reducing complexity and increasing simplicity.
I think so, but it's how do I put it? It basically is, like I was saying, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're letting the customers discover their own value. And it also doesn't mean that they're co-creators. It's sort of like a step before either of those, where you do a lot of the value creation and they'll find it in their office tomorrow when they get in.
Well, let's look at another angle of the value theory. You talked about the metrics of your service, the openings and the fatigue curve, you called it, and some of the other metrics that you can develop, which sound very functional. And as Austrians, we always like to think about the subjective value, the emotional value that the consumer feels, the end reader of your emails. Do you have any metrics on that? On, I guess the usual word is engagement, but we've got to go deeper than that. How people react in an emotional sense to your emails, and do they bond with the brands and all that kind of stuff? Can you measure that?
Well, I don't know that I've ever tried. I suppose, again, I would say, at the moment, the cost of doing so is probably not worth the benefit that you receive. So, again, I'll take a bit of a simpler brush at it, which is, if the people that you're marketing to are buying things, then there's some kind of a positive result there. If you see that as a result of your marketing, they're buying less things, then that means you're overdoing it and need to back off. So it's a bit of a reactive approach versus a sort of more of a proactive or qualitative approach. But effectively, one of the nice things about digital marketing is you can put control groups on absolutely everything. And so that's the primary mode of going and getting some of that information. And then it's just a pure matter of if you're seeing increases in engagement rates, you're doing the right things. If you're seeing decreases, you're doing the wrong things, and that sort of thing. Maybe I've been colored by living over here in Asia for the last 10 years, but I've become a believer that there's absolutely no such thing as loyalty whatsoever. So
yeah. Digital companies tend to define loyalty as math these days. It's about how often you buy and how frequently you buy. So it's not really emotional. But what you've described actually is very reassuring, because that's behavioral analysis. Correct. What did they do?
Yep.
And you can deduce emotions from that, perhaps, but the data is behavioral, which is very appropriate for Austrian economics.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the key, is what do people actually do versus what do you think they're going to do or hope they're going to do? And it's the closest way to approximate it, because you get lots of data points for an individual. You guys probably still have Uber there in the States. We use Grab mm-hmm. over here now. But they're pretty good at predicting where I want to call a taxi to take me to, because I do it every day. If I'm going to work, we've got lots and lots and lots of data points predicting that that's where I want to go at that time of day.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly with digital marketing, you get lots and lots of behavioral data points, but people always want to do things like predict whether somebody's likely to buy something from you or not. Most of the people that you have access to, they've never bought anything from you. The second most common thing is that they bought from you one time, and very, very uncommon is that they've bought from you multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody who wants to do, preferences based off of content or products that you might like or that sort of thing is they're really doing a lot of guessing, because they just don't have a pattern of behavior enough to demonstrate it.
Okay. I missed one diversion in our journey story, Paul. You mentioned early on that going out to raise capital is probably not a good way to build a business or grow a business. And then you said there was a point in time where you were going out to raise a round in Singapore. So just take us through that. Just take us yeah. through capital for entrepreneurs from your standpoint.
Yeah. So what I was actually saying is you don't need to go build your own capital, and you shouldn't be spending your own capital to go build a business. Mm-hmm. So that was an early line of thought that I had, was that, if you accumulate your own capital, then you can start your own business. That's not at all the case, and any entrepreneurial venture should be backed by people who have more capital than the person who's starting the company. So I'm 100% a believer in going and fundraising, whether from whatever sources makes sense, to go and build and grow a business. An entrepreneur should be great at identifying opportunities and being able to take action to go bring that to fruition. But there's other people with capital, and those are the people who should fund the business. So,
yeah. You mentioned, I think you raised some friends and family funding, and then you went out to the VC community. Were you very thoughtful about what stage of development you should be in to do that? Or was it, hey, I need the money, so I need to go out there? How did you manage that?
No, it was fairly thoughtful. And, I hadn't had, during my Silicon Valley days, an opportunity to go get involved with that world. So I had to go learn about the fundraising and venture capital business, understand how the models work. I contacted a lot of friends and other entrepreneurs and got some information about it and that sort of thing. One of the things that was interesting was, since we had started as sort of a more of an agency business and then evolved into a technology company, clearly we knew that the venture capitalists would be much more interested in the technology side of the business than the agency side of the mm-hmm. business. So we sort of had to rebrand ourselves and retrofit our business as a clear technology proposition versus sort of a hybrid agency technology proposition.
Yeah, you used the term agency-enabled technology company, which I thought was a nice way to bridge that.
Yeah, so I think that's it's sort of the inversion of what you would normally hear.
Right, exactly.
Tech-enabled agencies, which basically means their agency is better than other agencies because they have some tech that they use. To me, the agency business is purely a means to an end, which is to get the insights into what technology actually needs to be developed such that you can go build novel and interesting technology.
Mm-hmm. Right. They really are technology businesses now.
What's that?
So they really are technology businesses now, even though they call themselves agencies.
Yeah, that's true as well. So anyway, the that was sort of the business revolution, was getting repositioned into a technology business. And then we did all of our fundraising on the basis of the technology and the scale proposition around that.
And you're happy with the VC experience?
Yes and no. Obviously, we've got some amazing investors who've been super helpful in providing capital and building and growing the business. We've had some very good experiences. I would also say that there's the scene here was probably pretty early stage compared to the development of things in the Silicon Valley and stuff like that. So there's also some frustration in it, which is there's a lot of people trying to sort of replicate things that are being done in the Silicon Valley when, you know, our game out here in Asia is quite a bit different. And I think sometimes people look a little bit too much for copycats as opposed to more novel stuff.
Yep. Okay. So I'm just looking at the time. Let us approach a couple of wrap-up questions. Give us your retrospective now with a view to helping our listeners, Paul. You look back on this entrepreneurial journey, on this experience, and how would you summarize it for people who might be thinking about starting such a journey or in the middle of such a journey? And what's your evaluation of the entrepreneurial, let's call it lifestyle or life journey?
Yeah. Well, I think people often see the successes of entrepreneurs who are successful, and it looks quite glamorous and quite glorious. There's absolutely nothing glamorous or glorious about things along the way. That only happens at the end stage of things. I think people need to be, you need to have a really, really thick skin and just be tough as nails if you want to go do it. But if you've got the fortitude to stick through the thick and thin, and there will be thick and there will be thin, then it can be a great way to live your life if that's something that's appeals to you. But there's nothing easy about it. Nothing comes easy, all of that kind of stuff. But you know, in terms of how I look at it, one thing I would say is it does make sense for whenever people are doing their first entrepreneurial activity is to do something that they've already got expertise in. I think a lot of people come up with an idea that seems interesting, but they don't really have the background or expertise in it. There's too much complication of running a business for the first time, that if you don't already have the subject matter expertise, you've got too many variables that are gonna collapse on you too quickly. Yeah. That's one piece. And the other piece is, you know, learn how to write a contract, learn how accounting works, learn the basic operations of business before you do anything entrepreneurial.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to plan a podcast on accounting specifically, because you're right. You need to know the basics of that so you don't go wrong. So last question. You mentioned Austrian economics. You're self-taught, or you've read a lot of Austrian economics. You've learned it yourself. Can you say it's helped you in any way? And what did you learn from it, and how have you applied it?
Well, you know, I think in the business sense, I suppose the most valuable thing that kind of rings true to me on a daily basis is just the subjectivity of value. I think especially when you get into building teams and managing large numbers of employees and things like that, the common misconception of the labor theory of value is very prevalent. And one of the things that I've had to do is just work to break that thinking for a lot of employees is, you know, I'll give it, like, an example would be somebody's, you know, they were working until 10 p.m. and then they screwed up and they sent out the wrong campaign and the customer's pissed off. And they think to themselves, well, you know, but the customer should be appreciative that I was working until 10 p.m. And then you have to just go, well, no, the value is going to be determined by the customer and the result that they got from it. If they're the ones paying you, they're going to be the ones to determine the value. So it doesn't matter if you were working hard. It matters if you delivered value. right?
Yeah, that's bringing the labor theory of value home. I like that story.
Yeah, so I think that's probably, I mean, if I was going to put one thing on, I would say it's sort of destroying the labor theory of value and driving the subjectivity of value has been the most important thing on a day-to-day basis.
And that works just as well in B2B business as B2C, the subjectivity of value as a way of thinking?
Absolutely. And it's interesting. When I listen to your podcast, Andre, I notice a lot of times we're thinking probably more along the lines of B2C type of businesses. So I'm kind of constantly sort of retrofitting it to my B2B world. But it's 100%, almost everything you say when you talk about sort of a consumer or a customer applies equally in the B2B world, but maybe with like an added layer of like psychological diagnosis that you have to go through when you're working more directly with the customer.
Yeah, we shouldn't be scared of including psychology in our definitions of subjective value. Well, Paul, thank you very much for this conversation. We've learned a ton. You're an enthusiastic and articulate expression of the entrepreneurial life. You built a fabulous business. We don't have time to talk about it, but I presume you're confident for the future. Is that right?
I am. But of course, I should mention we are fundraising at the moment. So if anybody out there is listening, give me a call.
Okay, good. Well, you and I can talk about that separately. But
Hunter, thanks so much for having me on. It's been great.
Well, thank you. We appreciate it very much. And let's talk again soon.
All right. Thanks, Hunter.
Thanks, Paul.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.